I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome Maga Bodhi, just be so kind to accept the invite to Goodyfield Festival to give a talk. I believe it's your first time at the festival.
It is.
Yeah, I initially hadn't really sort of thought of asking Maga Bodhi to give a talk, but then Kamishima suggested, like, why don't you ask Maga Bodhi to give a talk at the festival? And I asked him, and to my surprise, he instantly, almost instantly, I think, said yes. So. And then I was thinking about who I should ask to introduce Maga Bodhi. We usually ask people to introduce Maga Bodhi. And then thinking, well, why don't I introduce Maga Bodhi? Because actually, I think I've known Maga Bodhi personally for about 10 years now.
I think so.
And Maga Bodhi is a senior order member of the Western Buddhist Order. And I got to know him in his capacity at the time of the president of the Amsterdam Buddhist Center, which I used to be connected to. And so it's just sort of very pleasant memories of Maga Bodhi coming by sort of every year or so and giving a very good talk, which everybody loved. And just having very good conversations with him. Just sitting in the sunshine and...
good coffee.
Drinking good coffee. And just,
chips.
Yeah. Discussing stuff that was really important to me in our Sangha at the time. And him being somebody who could just give a bit more of an objective kind of reflection on that. He's also quite known for his work for Windhorst Publications. He's been the founder of Windhorst Publications, in fact. Windhorst Publications is present at the festival, or are present, I should say. But unfortunately, their store has been blown away, so they've had to pack it in. But lots of their books are available.
Wouldn't have happened in my time. Oh, yeah.
Lots of their books are available in Dear Mappi's bookshop here. And, Sarah, who works for Windhorst, asked me who are the people who are talking Dharmapali, actually written a book for Windhorst. And Maga Bodhi is one of them. He's written a book called Jai Bin, ages ago, and about his work in India, maybe. So. He's also known, very much known for his book, Jai Bin. Anyway, I won't keep you waiting much longer. I'd just like to introduce Maga Bodhi, our speaker. And
thank you, Maga Bodhi. Have you any idea how uncomfortable this chair is? At least it would be better, I think, if there was a beer there. It would all feel different, but I'll do my best. Now, Professor Richard Gombrich came here in wonderful, shiny shoes. I don't know how it happened, but he got here in this immaculate pair of shoes. I left his lecture and discovered that my Wellington boots had disappeared. So that's one difference between an Oxford professor and a member of the Western Buddhist Order. It's not the only difference, as I'm sure my talk will soon reveal. But I'm going to talk also on the theme of truth and beauty, and I think I called it something like coming home to the beauty in oneself. And maybe, in some respects, it's a little bit of a defense of the idea of beauty in relation to Buddhism and Buddhist practice, though not from the sort of scholarly point of view that Professor Gombrich was offering us a little while ago. I'm going to start with a personal memory. When I was about 10, my parents took me out for tea, scones, jam, cream, in a little place by the river in Henley. And as I sat there eating my lovely scones, jam and cream, I noticed on the wall among the horse brasses and the sort of the hay wain and all the other Henley type images, a kind of cod bit of Chinese graphics. It was a tile with blue spiky type and a little fat man next to it. And it said, old Chinese proverb, if you have but two pennies left, with one buy a loaf of bread, with the other a flower. The bread will give life, the flower a reason for living. And that little trite platitudinous proverb really hit me at that age, and it stayed with me. It never left me. It just seemed to me to be saying something that I instantly, intuitively agreed with, that there is a link between beauty, nature, and meaning, and truth. That in some way beauty is as necessary to life as food. Whether it's an autumn leaf, or a Rembrandt painting, a Beethoven quartet, or a Lakeland Valley, they're seeming to say something, something meaningful that I need, that I feed off, that I can't actually live for very long without. I found a lovely little quote somewhere. In everyone's heart, there is a secret nerve that answers to beauty. And I'm not saying that that proverb woke me up to that secret nerve. I think the secret nerve was there. But that proverb reminded me of it, or articulated it for me. And in some ways, that silly little proverb changed my life. It seemed to me that beauty has something to say about life, about the human condition, about how things are, about how things could be. And often beauty says it much more eloquently than can the best religious texts and tracts that anyone's ever written. It was amidst beauty that I suppose I'd put it, began my spiritual journey, my spiritual life. I was 18 or 19 on holiday from university with some friends, camping on a beach in Portugal. We got flooded out that time as well. But before that happened, I one day, in a way spontaneously, it was sparked off by a series of thoughts I'd been having, but the experience that I had was totally unexpected and in some respects seemingly totally disconnected. I had an experience, a momentary experience, a flash of experiencing no difference between me and the sand dunes and the sea and the sky. I don't know how long it lasted, but for me it was a deeply profound, life-changing experience. It set me on a path. I couldn't put it down. I couldn't forget it, even though I spent 2 or 3 years as a student desperately trying to bury it under drugs, sex, and whatever else I could get my hands on. But that experience and the memory of that experience never left me. And by stages, through haphazard reading, talking to friends, I found my way eventually to Buddhism, to the Dharma. Now, in a way, Buddhism, it was perhaps a little bit of a surprise, because Buddhism doesn't really have a lot of time for beauty, as Professor Gombrich recently was telling us. It's got, if anything, a little bit of a downer on beauty. Siddhartha didn't leave home drawn towards the beauty of the transcendental. He left home and pursued his spiritual journey driven by the problem of the human condition, driven by a sort of fevered desire to get to the bottom of old age, sickness, death, issues as fundamental and as painful as that. And when he found his liberation, he spoke as having found the answer, having found the solution, having stilled the storm, having found his way out of the wheel. And yeah, as we've heard, Buddhist texts would seem to have this downer on beauty. I won't give you lots of quotes, we've heard a few already, but I'll mention a couple of anecdotes. In Ann Arbor in America once, I attended a conference of world Buddhists from all over the place, who had found themselves landed now in America trying to teach the Dharma. And at one point, a young monk, very nice, sweet man from Thailand, I think, in the middle of his talk, wanted an analogy. And he said, well, it's like the beauty of a rose. And then he gave this coy little smile and covered his face. And he said, well, of course, I'm a monk. I'm not allowed to enjoy the beauty of a rose. It quite shocked me to hear that. There is this practice in the Buddhist tradition, the asubha bhavana, the contemplation, as it's put, the contemplation of the ugly. Specifically, it's about contemplating the ugly aspects of the human body. So that doesn't say an awful lot of Buddhism's sort of enjoyment of beauty. And then once on the summer school of the British Buddhist Society many years ago, I don't know what they're like these days, but a friend of mine was giving a talk about Dharma practice, and during the course of it he mentioned the importance of surrounding yourself with beauty, that if you're trying to practice a spiritual life you need to refine your consciousness, refine your emotional life, and you can do this through the enjoyment of aesthetic experience. And the next day, during the question and answer session that was set up, as was their habit for visiting speakers, he was damn nearly lynched. I mean, people were scarlet in the face, in their fury, as they attacked him for denying the fundamental Buddhist practice and truth of dukkha, of suffering, that, you know, as they saw it, one needs to have one's mind firmly locked into dukkha all the time, and this idea of enjoying beauty was an absolute contradiction. Does anyone have any water? I bought a bottle and then rather carelessly left it somewhere, and I'd love, thank you, Mira. What I think was happening to these people was that they were confusing the sort of mundane truth of suffering, you know, that things sometimes are bad, life can be shit, with the Aryan truth of suffering, the noble truth of suffering, the truth as seen from the standpoint of transcendental experience, as seen from the standpoint of awakening, relative to which ordinary mundane life, even beautiful, glorious mundane life, is not up to the mark. It's not truly beautiful in the way that spiritual beauty can be. There's a little story from the Pali Canon that goes some way to illustrate this. One of the Buddha's disciples called Nanda had recently got married, and while the Buddha had passed through, he'd sort of got lured away by the Buddha's convincing words, and he'd gone off to practice the Dharma. He'd left his wife, he'd left home, as had the Buddha, and was sitting under a tree trying to meditate, but was constantly distracted, constantly unhappy, because he missed his wife. The Buddha found out about his problem and took him by some magical means to a heavenly realm, where he saw 500 nymphs who were pink-footed and who displayed an ethereal, unbelievable level of beauty. And the Buddha said, "Well, how does your wife look now?" And he said, "Oh, sir, you know, relative to these women, she's like a mutilated half-monkey with no eyes or ears." And the Buddha said, "Well, look, if you practice hard, I will let you go to this heaven and you'll get one of those nymphs." I mean, the story goes on that when the other monks found out that Nanda was only meditating in order to get himself a nymph, they made such fun of him that in response he had no other resort except to gain enlightenment, whereupon he enjoyed the real beauty, the absolute beauty of transcendental experience. But perhaps one of the things this story is showing is that there is a kind of hierarchy, that there is mundane beauty that we live with and are often satisfied by and are attracted to and get trapped by, and there are degrees and degrees of higher, more refined beauty, culminating perhaps in the beauty of transcendental experience. It's worth just digressing for a moment that, you know, it's worth actually asking what the spiritual life is based on. Arguably what the spiritual life is based on is our capacity as human beings to stand back from our experience and reflect on it. We're not chained to instinct, we're not chained to impulse, we don't live in a blind world of just the grass in front of our nose that we want to eat or the next animal we're going to kill. We take, we eat, we survive, but we can also think about it. We can stand back from our experience and know what our experience is. This is a distinctively and uniquely human faculty. It's the faculty that allows us to form ideas, even ideals. It's the faculty that allows us to imagine things. It's the faculty that allows us to empathize with others, ultimately even to feel compassion for others. So it's the faculty that gives us the potential for awakening, ultimately. But it's also the faculty that allows us to want more than we need. It's the faculty that allows us to form ideas about the world that are wrong. And so on. It's the faculty that's responsible for all the aberrations that the human race is subject to and that get us individually and collectively into so much trouble. So it's just worth putting that in as a little kind of, well, it's not really a digression. In some ways it goes to the core of things. I'll pick it up again in a little while. But, you know, perhaps what the Buddha is saying to Nanda, and perhaps through the story, one of the things he's saying to us is, don't waste your capacity to idealize. You know, if you're going to idealize, if you're going to form a thirst, a craving, an obsession with something, because you've added to that something more than it's actually got, well, use that faculty for imagination, for idealization, for pushing yourself towards higher and higher levels of consciousness, of refinement, of enjoyment, even of beauty. I would argue that there's an awful lot of beauty around in the Buddhist tradition. You know, it's there, it's implicit. In a way, sometimes it's so obvious you don't think of it as beauty. I mean, it seems to me interesting that the first chroniclers of the Buddha's speech, even though they were hundreds of years later, and I, any more than anyone else, can't say what was going on when the Buddha was walking and talking, but when the first scriptures got written 500 years after he died, interestingly, when the Buddha spoke, they put his words into verse. He didn't just speak prose. He spoke verse. They needed to adorn what he said. They needed to couch his words in a mantle of beauty. I'll read you a few verses, just a few verses from a Mahayana source. In praise of the Buddha, in praise of the Buddha's form, lovely yet calming, bright but not blinding, gentle yet strong. Who would not be inspired just to see you? The joy one feels on beholding you for the first time does not diminish even after seeing you 100 times. Each time it is seen, your form gives joy. Its beauty is such that one is never satisfied. Your body is worthy as a receptacle, and your virtues are worthy as occupants. Both are excellent in themselves, and both complement each other perfectly. And then, of course, there are the texts of the Pure Land School, where so heavenly worlds are described in great detail, sometimes in natural language, sometimes in the exalted language of rivers that speak Dharma, of jewel trees that twinkle messages of the Dharma, and so on. And Buddhist history, I would say, is replete with Buddhist art, Buddhist poetry, and so on. Whether it's these verses or the way the Buddha is made to speak in the sutras, I suppose what the artists, the writers, the chroniclers are trying to do is to, in some way, through their art, through their skill, through the beauty of the words or the images that they can create, they're trying to evoke the awakened state, give us some hint of what the awakened state might be. And in that way, what they're trying to do is offer us the necessary inspiration we need in order to make the efforts to awaken ourselves. I'd say that beauty in the Buddhist tradition has another function. In a way, it has the function, sometimes it's offered to us as a kind of path, a path of practice, a kind of samatha meditation practice. Samatha meditation is that dimension, that aspect of meditation that has to do with calming the mind, enriching the mind, harmonizing the energies of the mind, enriching, strengthening and nourishing the mind. It's an almost indispensable preparation for receiving and absorbing the shock of insight. As Eliot said, humankind cannot stand very much reality without the nourishment, the enrichment and the calming down of samatha meditation. We can't take truth, we can't take reality, and so we need to do practices that give us that kind of opening, that receptivity, that softness, malleability, and so on. And sometimes beauty is offered to us as a kind of samatha practice. There's an outstanding example, again from the Mahayana tradition, if I can find it, by the monk, poet, mystic Shantideva. I don't know where he's gone. Seems to have disappeared. Give me one moment. Okay. Yeah, here's a tiny little snatch from a text written in the 8th century by Shantideva. Shantideva tried to produce a manual of the spiritual life. It's called the Bodhicharya Avatara. It's a very short book, but it offers a complete overview of spiritual life and spiritual practice, beginning with an inspirational sales pitch for the whole idea of practicing a spiritual life, and then taking us through a series of practices and approaches to how to do it. He devotes the second and third chapters to a kind of guided meditation in which, helping us to traverse a series of moods, he gives us a kind of rehearsal of the state of mind of an enlightened being. It's a very profound practice. It's a very demanding practice. Sometimes we do it in the FWBO, in the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, or at least a part of it, as a kind of collective ritual. But it can also be practiced alone as a meditation. Now, this meditation begins, interestingly, not with all kinds of spiritual truths, but with a simple immersion in beauty. First of all, Shantideva throws before us all kinds of images of just natural beauty, of lakes, of the cry of wild geese, of waterfalls, of cultivated and uncultivated harvests, and so on. But after a little while, after a few more verses, this is how he's talking once... once he's invited the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to come and join him. He says, "I offer them jeweled lamps mounted in a row of golden lotuses, and I scatter lovely drifts of blossoms on the floor, anointed with perfume. To those filled with love, I also offer brilliant multitudes of palaces, delightful with songs of praise, radiant with garlands of pearls and jewels, and ornamented at the entrances in four directions. I bring to mind the great sages, exquisitely beautiful, jeweled parasols, perfectly raised with golden handles, lovely shapes, and inlaid pearls. Thereafter, may delightful clouds of offerings rise high, and clouds of instrumental music that enrapture all sentient beings." And so on, and so on. Interestingly, and I'll stay with Shantideva just for a little bit longer, as this guided meditation progresses, he takes us through this evocation of beauty, first natural, then ethereal. He takes us deeper and deeper into a mood of beauty and inspiration, whereupon he then introduces into our mind the possibility that we could take part in that. We could become a part of that dance of beauty by becoming Buddhas and Bodhisattvas ourselves. And his poetry is so convincing that you find yourself following him as he gets us through the lines of the verses to commit ourselves to that journey. And almost the moment we do that, he shifts the mood, he pulls the rug out from under our feet and leads us into pages of really seriously difficult, hard, graphic confession of everything we've ever done wrong or thought. It's an interesting sort of theorem that he's thrown at us. It's as if access suddenly to these wonderful higher realms that he's led us towards is denied. And sometimes it's like that. You know, sometimes beauty works, and sometimes it doesn't. Somebody once said, "There's no object so beautiful that under certain conditions it will not look ugly." I think that was Oscar Wilde. Sometimes I can feel completely cut off from a sunset, a beautiful sunset in the middle of the Lake District, or completely dead to a concert that I'm listening to because I've had a hard day or whatever. And at other times I can just be stopped in mid step on the street because of the beauty of the way the sun is throwing a shadow against a dirty brick wall, or by the way the water sparkles as it falls out of a tap into the sink. Sometimes nature, sometimes an artist can reach me. Sometimes I'm unreachable. I'm not ready. It can seem sometimes as if beauty is a bit like grace. It just kind of descends almost accidentally by sheer luck. But I don't think it's like that. I think that the capacity to see beauty is a bit like one's capacity to see truth, to see meaning. It's not an accident, and it's not an accident because it's not a one-way affair. On some level or other, consciously or unconsciously, in order to experience beauty, we have to engage. We have to participate, make our own contribution. This applies at every level. Sophia Loren once said, to me, beauty is half what I've got and half what they like to think I've got. Moving to another level, Vermeer's Milkmaid, a beautiful painting of a woman just pouring milk out of a jug into a bowl, I think. I mean, I've stood in Amsterdam and looked at that picture many times. It's as if in order to enjoy that picture, in order to respond to that picture, because I've got a reproduction of it at home and there are days when I do and days when I don't respond, it's as if I have to be in touch with that part of me that longs for and resonates with tranquility, contentment, the kind of mood that Vermeer is evoking in that painting. And then a Bach fugue, you know, maybe on, you know, arguably a higher level yet. You know, I have to be in touch to enjoy something like that, with that intuition, that intimation I have that there are patterns, there is a rhythm, there is a, you know, some kind of order in reality, in the universe. To enjoy beauty out there, something in me has to be ready to resonate with it. And for that to happen, I have to be available. I have to be in touch with something in myself. I have to be open to the message, the influence of beauty. And in order to be in touch with it, usually what I find is that I have to ask myself, what's stopping me? It's not as if often there's something I have to do. You can't do a smash and grab raid on beauty. It's more a matter of needing to give something up. And often what I have to give up is my self-importance, the idea that I am the most important thing in the universe, that the rest of reality is just a kind of vague backdrop to the drama of my life. It's back to that aberrant feature of human nature, the aberrant feature that allows us to gain enlightenment, but which also allows us to think that we're not part of nature, to stop resonating, to stop being in touch. We start to see things entirely through the lens of our wants, our needs, our preferences. Got a lovely description here which sums up this side of human nature. Somebody called Frederick Turner wrote this. To those who followed Columbus and Cortes, the New World truly seemed incredible because of the natural endowments. The land often announced itself with a heavy scent miles out into the ocean. Giovanni de Verrazzano, in 1524, smelled the cedars of the east coast 100 leagues out. The men of Henry Hudson's Half Moon were temporarily disarmed by the fragrance of the New Jersey shore, while ships running further up the coast occasionally swam through large beds of floating flowers. Wherever they came inland, they found a rich riot of colour and sound, of game and luxuriant vegetation. Had they been other than they were, they might have written a new mythology. As it was, they took inventory. So we have to experience beauty to get beyond ourselves, to get beyond the limited little world, the limited little perspective of our drama, in which we're looking at things entirely in terms of what it can do for us, or in what way does it threaten me. To do that, there's something we kind of have to do first of all. That is, to even know that that's happening, to even want to see beyond that little drama, we have to simply stop. We have to stop the flow of life as it is. Stop and look. I'm going to read you another similar sort of lengthed quote, but which says something about this need. One summer night, this is from Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring. One summer night, out on a flat headland, all but surrounded by the waters of the bay, the horizons were remote and distant rims on the edge of space. Millions of stars blazed in darkness, and on the far shore, a few lights burned in cottages. Otherwise, there was no remainder and no reminder of human life. We were alone with the stars, the misty river of the Milky Way flowing across the sky, the patterns of the constellations standing out bright and clear, a blazing planet low on the horizon. It occurred to me that if this were a sight that could be seen only once in a century, this little headland would be thronged with spectators. But it can be seen many scores of nights in any year, and so the lights burned in the cottages, and the inhabitants probably gave not a thought to the beauty overhead. And because they could see it almost any night, perhaps they never will. So in order to see, in order to look, in order to resonate and appreciate, we have to just stop. We have to stop the flow of habit, stop the flow of routine, stop the little lives that we lead in our little cottages, step out of what's sometimes referred to as automatic pilot, and just become quite simply present to our experience in this moment, whatever it is. It all comes down, I'd say, at least at the beginning and for a very long time to come, to what's referred to as mindfulness. Mindfulness, whether of the body and our breath, mindfulness of our thoughts, mindfulness of our feelings, mindfulness of just what's in front of us, a blade of grass, a carpet, a person, whatever it is. We have to find a way of just stopping, calming, and looking and receiving. During this event here at Butterfield, I know there are people teaching meditation and mindfulness, so I'm not going to be leading you through a guided practice. If there weren't, this would probably be where I'd end my talk, and I would just now lead you into a mindfulness exercise. Instead, what I'll do is strongly exhort you, if you haven't practiced meditation or mindfulness, to, at the very first opportunity, get yourself off somewhere where you can learn a little bit of basic, simple mindfulness practice. You don't need to learn much. In a way, it would simply be enough to sit quietly and watch your breath for a little while. That'll take you a very, very long way. But it comes down to mindfulness. It's interesting, when I was... It's funny that you mentioned Windhorse Publications. I can remember about 20 years ago having a conversation with somebody who was working with me. I said, you know, every few years a bestseller comes along in the Buddhist world. I mean, we don't really get bestsellers in the Buddhist world, but if we do, they are always about mindfulness, no matter how they're dished up, and whether it's in Tibetan clothes or Theravada, Sri Lankan clothes or Thai clothes, it's mindfulness. The bestsellers, look at any publisher's list of best-selling Buddhist titles, they'll be about mindfulness. When I, 1,000 years ago, worked for the BBC, I worked on a TV series called The Long Search, which some of you might remember, from the early 70s, and there were two episodes devoted to Buddhism, and one of them ended as the credits rolled over a shot from a telephoto lens, low angle, a monk walking mindfully away from the camera, then turning around and walking back towards it as the titles rolled. And for years afterwards, being an impoverished Buddhist, hitchhiking around the place, whenever I mentioned to the driver that I was a Buddhist, they'd always say, "Oh yes, Buddhism. Yeah, I saw this bloke on television. He was walking." All it was a pair of feet. But somehow between them, the monk and the cameraman had contrived to communicate mindfulness. And it was such a striking image, and I'd argue it was such a beautiful image, that even in people who knew nothing about Buddhism, and possibly were never going to go on to have anything to do with Buddhism, years later they remembered that image. Something in them had resonated with that image, just in the same way as we resonate with beauty when it's before us. It's always been a miracle to me how effective meditation, mindfulness is. I mean, it's affected me in all kinds of ways, but if I'm honest, what I look for and what I hope for when I sit down on my cushion in the morning is that it's going to open me to the experience of beauty. I can remember on the very first Buddhist retreat I went to, the experience of walking into a room, I think it was the toilet, and the kind of line, though, it had that texture where it sparkles. Yeah, just like the stars in the sky, twinkles. And just walking into this toilet and finding myself in this heavenly realm. I mean, I'd been into that kind of room with that kind of floor countless times before, but never had I been so open to it. I wasn't on drugs, honest. And equally on that retreat, I can remember, you know, just walking out in the morning and seeing the mist in the trees. It wasn't that I'd never been in a forest before, it wasn't I hadn't seen mist before, and it wasn't that I'd never responded to beauty before, but my capacity, my receptors, my capacity to be moved by something, you know, more, you know, an experience that I could only describe as an experience of beauty, was remarkably enhanced. Not long after the retreat, I stood on a clifftop looking down at the sea at night, and a wave came in and just crashed on the shore, and it was in itself beautiful. It also seemed to be reminding me of just how much of my life I spent in the surf, you know, in that momentary flash of whiteness that I was seeing down below me at the sea's edge, that's where I lived, while there was this whole ocean with everything in it just beyond that narrow strip of surf. And I don't know whether the experience was just in the sight, or in the combination of the sight and the thought, whether the thought was inspired by the sight, or whether the sight was enriched by the thought, but put it all together, and it was an experience of sublime wonder and beauty that just transfixed me at that moment, which was a fruit of the practice. Sometimes it isn't even necessary, if you meditate, and anyone who meditates will know this, it's not even necessary to find yourself on a cliff looking at the sea. It's enough to just be sitting on a cushion breathing. Those moments when you just feel a complete contentment, a complete enoughness to the experience of sitting there, poised, dignified, happy, alive. Just simply there. And as I say, it can be enough just to spend a little bit of time watching your breathing. That can be enough to just nudge us out of our routine, out of our habit, out of the flow of our mind, out of the false idealizations that we get so wrapped up in, so attached to, so deluded by. Even to just spend a few minutes following your breath can be enough to just shift the mood, shift the receptors, and allow you to become open to other things, and above all to be open, as I say, to this capacity in yourself to receive beauty. It's what I call it in my title and in my own head a coming home to myself, to experience even a hint of the depths just beneath the passing thoughts and moods and preoccupations that I live with, to just have a glimpse, even for a moment sometimes, behind all that clutter, to the depths, to the wholeness that lies just underneath it, can feel utterly miraculous. And at those moments, my world is transformed into a place of beauty. Maybe it's beautiful because beneath the dramas, beneath the narratives, the ups and downs of my little story, I, like everyone else, is no more and no less than a miraculously complex, self-aware manifestation of a reality that I share with everyone and everything else. When I'm in touch with it in myself, I'm in touch with it in others. I'm in touch with it as it manifests all around me. I'm reminded of something that Walt Whitman said. I think it's a long time since I read this quote, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he said, "I sing of the joy of coexistence." You know, that meditation offers us a path to the joy of coexistence. Coexistence with others, with other people, just coexistence with everything and anything. It's a coexistence in a reality that, well, in Buddhism is never defined and summed up. In the Buddhist world, that reality is described blankly as being atakavacharo, beyond the reach of words and concepts. It can only be hinted at in words, words like emptiness, words like the void, words like one mind, words like dependent origination, and so on. But luckily, to nail down and define reality, to understand it, is not the point. The point is to uncover it in ourselves, to become more complete, more whole, more alive, and more in tune with how things are, able to let reality in. This takes commitment and effort, but it's worth it, because the deeper we go into it, and the deeper we go into it in ourselves, the more we can see it, we can see that reality, respond to it, resonate with it, enjoy it in others all around us. I think I'll leave it there so that there's some time for discussion, questions, or whatever.